May 18th, 1962, Lecture 48, Beats. May 18th, 1962, Lecture 48, Beats. May 18th, 1962, Lecture 48, Beats.
Shut the doors, sir. Some time ago, we discussed in considerable detail the properties of light waves and their interference, that is, the effects of the superposition of two waves from different sources. But in all the analyses, we assumed that the frequencies of the sources were always the same. And today we have to discuss those phenomena, or some of those phenomena, which are associated, which are the result of the interference between two sources, which have different frequencies. It's easy to guess what's going to happen. Suppose that we have the two sources in the way that we have done before, and we stand over here at some point, and that the two phases, say, are so adjusted that the signal is in phase. They both have the same frequency. It stays in phase, and at that point is very loud. Or if it was light, very strong. Or if it were electrons, many of them arrive. On the other hand, if the phase was 180 degrees out, you would get no signal here, because there's a minimum. Now, suppose that someone diddles the phase knob here and changes the phase back and forth. Say, first he makes it zero, and then you get it strong, and then it makes it 180, and you get it weak, and so on. So you get variations. Now, you see that if the phase of this is slowly changing, and relative to this, in a gradual uniform manner, starting at zero, going up to 10, 20, 30, 40, so on degrees, then what you would hear here, or see here, or whatever way you've got to detect it, would be a series of pulsing. Because when it starts at zero, it's strong, and then as it shifts over to 180 degrees, it gets weak, and then it shifts to 360, it gets strong again, and so on. Here's a pulsing. But, of course, to say that another source is shifting its phase relative to this at a uniform rate is the same thing as to say that the number of oscillations that this is acquiring per second is slightly different than that. So we know the answer. If we have two sources of different frequency, we should get an output result, which will be a pulsing variation between the two. And that's all there is to the subject. It's very easy to formulate mathematically also. I take, for example, that we have two waves. We don't have to worry for a moment about all the spatial relations. Simply take what arrives here. From one source, let's say, we would have cosine omega 1t, and from the other source, cosine omega 2t, where the two omegas are not exactly the same. Of course, the amplitudes may not be the same, and we can do a general problem later. Let's first take the case when the amplitudes are equal. Then the total amplitude, which arrives here, is the sum of those two. In short, we have to add a wave of one frequency. I plot now against the time the amplitude of the first wave, and then another one. I don't know if I can draw it very well, but it was a slightly different frequency. That is a different frequency, you can see, because these crests coincide, but this coincides with a trough. Now, when we add these two things together, and so it coincides again with a crest, and then a trough, and then a crest, and then a trough. And so when we add these two things together, here where the crests coincide, we get a strong wave, and then where the trough and crest coincide, we get practically zero. And then when it crests coincide, we get a strong wave again, so you wah, wah, and so on. Mathematically, we need only to add two cosines and to rearrange it somehow to find out what we get. And I've written on a board a number of relations among cosines, which you probably know, but just to derive them for you, you know that e to the ia plus b is e to the ia times e to the ib, and that e to the ia has a real part cosine, imaginary part sine. So this is the same product over here. If I take the real part of this, I get the cosine. If I multiply this out, I get cosine a cosine b, minus sine A sine B plus some imaginary parts. But I'm taking the real part, so I got that. Now, if I put B equal minus, change the sign of B, since the cosine doesn't change the sine does, the same equation for negative B is this. And if I add these two equations together, I'll get rid of this sine business, and I get that the product of two cosines is half the cosine 1 plus half the cosine of the sum and half the cosine of the difference. These things I'm sure you know from trigonometry. I'm just going, in case you never saw it before, there it is. Now, I can reverse the formula, put the two on the other side, and find a formula for cosine alpha plus cosine beta by saying let alpha equal a plus b and let beta equal a minus b, so that, for example, a is a half of alpha plus beta and b is a half of alpha minus beta, and then I have this result. Therefore, I can analyze this thing. The sum of these two is twice the cosine of half frequency difference times t times the cosine of omega 1 plus omega 2 over 2t. Now, just for an interesting example that we've represented here, let's suppose that the two frequencies are nearly the same, so that the omega 1 plus omega 2 over 2 is the average frequency between them, which is more or less one or the other. But omega 1 minus omega 2 is much smaller than omega 1 plus omega 2 because I said that they were nearly equal. That means that we can represent the solution by saying that there's a high frequency cosine wave like the ones we started with, but that its size is slowly changing. And its size is pulsating with a frequency which appears to be omega 1 over omega 2 minus 2. I mean, divided by 2. And then we get into a lot of debates as to what the right frequency is. You see, the question involved is, since this says that the amplitude goes as cosine, it says that the amplitude goes like this. And what it's really telling us is a special detail, that the maximum of this at the top here would have the wave plus. Well, if you looked at the other side over here, where it was the strongest, where it looked like it was repeating itself, it wasn't exactly repeating itself, because the maximum was where it was negative. And so you could say that the amplitude goes at a low frequency. But if you're talking about the intensity of the wave or the size of this thing, then you like to think that it's twice as frequent. So you could say the amplitude, the modulation of the amplitude in a sense of the strength of it or the intensity of it is at omega 1 minus omega 2. Although the formula tells us that we multiply by a cosine wave at half that frequency, the technical reason is that the high frequency wave has got a little bit different phase relationship in the second cycle, a little complication. The main point is then if we add two frequencies of omega 1 and omega 2, we will get a net resulting wave which oscillates in strength with a frequency omega 1 minus omega 2. If the two amplitudes are different, we can do it all over again by having A and A1 and A2 here and do a lot of mathematics, rearranging and so on, using equations like this. Other ways of doing the same analysis is this. We know that we can represent a wave as the real part of e to the I omega 1 t, and that the other wave would be the real part of A2, e to the I omega 2 t, and that if we add the two together, we get this. Now, with exponentials, it's much easier to do everything than it is with sines and cosine, and this wave can be written this way. If we take out the average frequency, then the first wave is the difference frequency times over 2 times the average frequency. This is the same as that because the omega 2s just cancel out. And the other one is the same with a minus sign. So those are the two waves, these two. But I'm adding them, and I can take out this exponential as a common factor. So you see that what we have when we've added the two together is this thing in front times this exponential. So again, we have the high frequency wave with a modulation at the lower frequency. If you ask for the intensity of that wave, for instance, you can either take the absolute square of this or take the absolute square of that. Let's take the first one. The intensity of the wave is the absolute square of this. And we've done these before when it was space or any other phase. If this was called, if there were a phase difference between the two, we know it comes out 2A1A2 times the cosine of the difference in phase, which in this case depends on the time, is the only new thing. And it depends on the time with the frequency omega 1 minus omega 2. So you see that the intensity swells and falls at a frequency omega 1 minus omega 2. Just like the drawings would indicate, you can easily imagine if I use two different sizes, this one were weaker than this one, then when I were reinforcing, it would be large, all right. But when they were undoing each other, it would only be small. It wouldn't be zero. And therefore, we'd get a wave that would go down for a while, come up for a while, so on. So it's all pretty clear what we should get. Finally, one more way to represent it is with a drawing. We want to add these two waves together. So we draw a vector to represent one of them in a complex plane, which is rotating at a frequency around omega 1, whose strength is A1. Then we have another one, which is going around at a frequency omega 2, and whose strength is A2. If the two frequencies are exactly equal, this triangle keeps revolving, and we get a definite resultant from the two. But if the frequency is slightly different, let's look at this, they go around at different speeds. So let us, look at it, what it looks like relative to this one. Then you see that A2 is turning slowly away from A1. And so the amplitude that you get by adding the two things, first is strong, and then it opens out. See, when it gets into this relative condition, it gets particularly weak and so on. And as these things go around, the amplitude, the sum vector just gets bigger and smaller and pulsates and so on. So it's a relatively simple idea, and there's seven different ways of representing the same thing. Now, I'd like to show it to you experimentally. I have it in the case of acoustics. I have arranged two loudspeakers with two oscillators, one to each loudspeaker, so that they each make a tone. At the present time, the oscilloscope isn't hooked up. It isn't hooked up to both speakers. It's only hooked up to one, so don't worry about it. And you will receive a note from one source and from the other source. And if I got the frequencies exactly the same, it would be a definite strength. I can't. The oscillators don't stand put. So I detune them a little bit, and then you should hear some variations. The further they're detuned, the more rapid would be the variations of sound. So we turn up one of the oscillators and the other. And now I try to get this, see if I can tune it. I'm off somewhere. Ah, success. See, they're slightly out of tune, and you hear a pulsing of the sound. If you make them more out of tune, that's more close. It's more rapid. More out of tune, still more rapid. Until the ear has some trouble in following that very rapid variation. Now I'll show you the thing on an oscilloscope. This thing simply adds the currents from the two speakers. The reason I didn't hook the oscilloscope in the first place is that technically is this way. After you hook them together, both speakers have the same signal, and it wasn't really interference acoustically. So to be absolutely honest, I showed you without that. Now both speakers are producing exactly the same sound. They're all wired together. And the result is shown on the oscilloscope. Now the frequency of pulsing is relatively low. But as we get it more rapid, you see the kind of wave I was drawing. And if we get higher frequency, then the bumps are closer together. Now if the amplitudes aren't equal, if I make one stronger than the other, then you see you get a wave that has not a complete oscillation, just as we've expected. So everything works the way it should, both acoustically and electrically, and everything's all right. Now, the opposite phenomenon occurs too. Suppose that you wanted to send a signal. In fact, in radio transmission, the way that the sound is carried by the radio station is this, that the radio transmitter has an AC electric oscillation, which is at a very high frequency, for example, 800 kilocycles in the broadcast band. So that if the signal is turned on, the radio station emits a wave which is uniform in size, unlike the drawing, which just, I don't think I'll get any more uniform the second time. Anyway. Uniform in size at 800,000 oscillations a second. Now, when the way the signals, the information is transmitted, the useless information about what kind of car to buy, the scheme is that when somebody talks and the microphone varies, the strength of the signal has changed. If we take for our simplest mathematical case the situation where the soprano is singing on a perfect note, perfectly sinusoidal oscillations of our vocal cords and everything, then what we would get out is a signal whose strength is alternating in this manner, where this alternation is then used in the receiver. You get rid of all this wave and you just look at this envelope, and this represents the oscillations of the vocal cords or the sound of the singer, and then that's made to make the corresponding vibrations at the same frequency in the air, and the ear is then essentially unable to tell the difference, so they say. Because of a number of distortions and so forth, it is possible to tell whether you're listening to a radio or listening to a soprano, but otherwise the idea is that. Now, the wave that we would have here then would be a cosine omega CT, where omega C represents what I'll call the frequency of the carrier. After, however, putting on a modulation, the strength of it or the amplitude of it would be of the form of a constant plus another constant times the frequency of the singer, which I call the modulation frequency. This is called amplitude modulation. We are modulating or varying the amplitude of the wave. This, then, is the complete wave. The old wave modulated. Again, we use all those theorems about the cosine. Or you can do this with e to the I. It doesn't make any difference. It's easier with e to the I, but it's the same thing. We get A cosine of omega CT plus B over 2, using the formula for the product of two cosines here, times the cosine of the sum of the two. Now, omega CT plus omega MT is omega C plus omega MT. And then we have another B over T cosine of omega C minus omega MT. So from another point of view, we can say that the output wave of the system consists of three waves added together in superposition. First, the normal wave, the regular wave at the frequency omega C, that is at the carrier frequency. And then two new waves at two new frequencies. One is the carrier frequency plus the modulation frequency, and the other is the carrier frequency minus the modulation frequency. If, therefore, you'd make some kind of a plot of the intensity that's being generated by the generator as a function of frequency, you'd find a lot of stuff at the frequency of the carrier, naturally. But when the singer starts to sing, you would suddenly find also intensity proportional to the strength of the singer, B, square, at frequency omega C plus M, omega M, and omega C minus omega M. These are called sidebands, and when there's some signal on the transmitter, there are sidebands. If the singer is making more than one note at the same time, or there are two instruments playing, or there's any other complicated wave with a different additional one on top of it, any other cosine in addition, then of course you can see from the mathematics that we get some more waves, but that they correspond to the frequencies omega C plus and minus omega M prime. And so therefore, when there's a complicated modulation, and it can be represented as a sum of many cosines, slight side remark, under what circumstances can a curve be represented as a sum of a lot of cosines? Answer, under all circumstances, except for the mathematicians, in which they, first of all, a curve has to not be a curve like that. Second of all, it has not to be that it jumps an infinite number of times in an infinitesimal distance or some other thing like that. But aside from that, any reasonable curve that a singer is going to be able to make by shaking a vocal cord, it's always possible to compound it by adding these waves. And so we find that the actual transmitter is transmitting over a range of frequencies, which is the carrier frequency plus or minus the maximum frequency that the signal contains that you want to modulate. So that although at first you believe that a radio transmitter transmits only at the frequency of the carrier, they advertise and they have big crystal oscillators in there and they got everything adjusted just so that they're at precisely 800 kilocycles. The moment they announce to you that they're at 800 kilocycles and they modulate therefore their 800 kilocycles, they're not at 800 kilocycles anymore. Suppose that they are able to transmit, and the amplifiers are so built and so on, that they transmit over a good range of the ear's sensitivity. The ear can hear up to 20,000 cycles, but usually radio transmitters and receivers don't work beyond 10. They don't hear the highest part. Suppose that's the case. Then, when the man is using things of 10,000 cycles of frequency of sound, the total frequency, the transmitter is transmitting stuff, which runs anywhere from 810 to 790 kilocycles. Now, if there were another station at 795, there would be a lot of confusion. If you made your receiver so sensitive that it only picks up 800 and doesn't get the 10 kilocycles on either side, you're not going to hear this, what he's saying, because the information is on the other frequencies. And therefore, it's necessary to keep the stations a certain distance apart, and also so that they don't overlap, the sidebands don't overlap. And second, that the receiver must not be too sensitive so that it does include a reception of the sidebands as well as the main frequency. This problem, in the case of sound, doesn't make too much trouble. We have a 20 kilocycle range, and we have usually from 500 to 1,500 kilocycles in the broadcast band, so there's plenty of room for lots of stations. The television problem is harder. In that case, we go across a light picture, a picture of some kind, and as the light moves, the beam goes across the picture, there are various little spots of light and dark that it wishes to, that light and dark is then going to be the signal. Now, ordinarily, it covers the whole picture, 500 lines approximately across the picture. It goes 500 lines and takes a 30th of a second. Yes, I know that it goes 250 in the first 60th and then goes in between in the next 60th. It doesn't make any difference. It does 500 lines in the 30th of a second. And if we can say that the resolution of the picture vertically and horizontally is more or less the same, there may be the same number of spots per inch this way. That is pieces of information. You'd like to be able to distinguish dark from light, dark from light, dark from light, say 500 lines. Actually not, because the picture's 3x4 and so on, but never mind all those little factors. You can put them in if you want to get it exactly right. So that we need, however, only a wavelength, though, so that the maximum to maximum is 250. See? So we have 250 times 500 times 30 pieces of information per second. Variations in the signal. The highest frequency that we're going to carry, therefore, is close to 4-some-odd megacycles, million cycles. Actually, to use the television station and to keep them apart, you have to leave enough room, a little bit more than this, and they leave approximately 6 megacycles. Part of it is to use to carry the sound signal and other information and to keep the stations apart. So megacycle channels are 6 megacycles, television channels are 6 megacycles wide. 6 million cycles, it certainly wouldn't be possible to transmit it at 0.8 million carrier. You can't modulate at a higher frequency than the carrier, or you're going crazy or something. At any rate, the television starts at 54 megacycles as the carriers, the first transmission channel, which is channel 2, as a matter of fact, has the frequency range from 54 to 60 megacycles, which is 6 megacycles frequency. But you say, you just proved that there were sidebands on both sides, and therefore it should be twice as wide. But it turns out that the boys are pretty clever. If you analyze this problem and use not just cosine, but cosine and sine to allow for phase differences to complete information, you'll see that there's a definite invariant relationship between the sideband on the high frequency side and the sideband on the low frequency side. What I mean is, if you will show me this curve, I can calculate this one. There's no new information on that other sideband. And so what is done is that sideband is suppressed, and inside the receiver, it's wired up so that the information which is missing is reconstituted by looking at this end of the sideband and the carrier. And so it's a clever scheme for decreasing the widths needed to transmit the information. That's enough of that. Now, the next subject I want to talk about is the interference of waves in both space and time. Suppose that we have two waves traveling in space. If we know that we can represent a wave traveling in space by e to the I omega t minus kx. That might be, for example, a displacement in the sound wave. You remember the wave equation for sound was the second derivative of chi with respect to x. Is equal to 1 over the speed of sound. This is the wave equation. It doesn't make any difference what the wave is. Anyhow, here we are. If you write chi equals this, or this times a constant if you want, you can see it's a solution if. Let's differentiate first. D chi dx, it's easy to differentiate an exponential. Why can I use an exponential in the real part? Because it's a linear equation, and I only can select at the end the real part if I want to. The imaginary part is another solution that I don't need. Now, if I differentiate chi with respect to x, I get minus ik times a times the exponential. Same stuff. If I differentiate again, I get minus ik again. If I differentiate with respect to t, I get I omega. So I get a. If I differentiate with respect to t again, I get I omega squared. Now these two will be equal within a factor c squared only if omega squared equals k squared c squared, where c is the speed of the wave, in our case sound or light. But you know that for the case of light, omega equal kc. For the case of sound, omega equal kcs. And it's also obvious without all this finagling around, because we know that the solution of this is, can be written in this form. Omega t minus k over omega x, for instance. Oh, no, I wrote it. Excuse me. E to the minus I k times x minus omega over kt. It's the same thing mathematically. We also know that this thing has a solution of the form a function of x minus ct. Therefore, this way it must be a wave which is traveling at this velocity omega over k. And that's c, and everything's all right. So it's two ways of seeing that. Now, I want to add two such waves together. Suppose that I have a wave that's traveling with one frequency, and another wave that's traveling with another frequency. I'll leave to you the cases when the amplitudes are different and all that other stuff, because it doesn't make any difference. Now we add these two together. We can add these two together by the same kind of mathematics that we added a single wave together. As a matter of fact, the first thing to remark is that it's kind of silly what I'm going to do, because you could say this is e to the I omega times t minus x over c, and this is e to the I omega 2 times t minus x over c. And all I did is the same thing as I did before, except t minus x over c is the variable instead of t. So that you get the modulations, but you see, of course, that those modulations are traveling out to you. They're moving along with the wave, naturally. In other words, if I added two waves like these, but these waves were not just oscillating, but moving in space, then the resultant wave would move along too at the same speed. But now I'd like to generalize this to another example, the case of waves which are not represented by this relationship, this wave equation, but the case of waves in which the relationship between the frequency and the wave number k is not so simple. Example one. Material with an index of refraction. When we studied the theory of index refraction, we found that we could write this way, that the k was omega c divided by n, the index. To take an interesting example, we took, for example, for x-rays, we got something like this for x-rays, that the index was 1 minus the number of atoms per cc times the charge on an electron squared over 2 epsilon naught times omega squared. We had more complicated formulas, but this one is as good as any as an example. Times the mass of the electron here, I forgot. Incidentally, we know that omega over k, by this argument here, even when omega and k are not proportional by c, omega over k is certainly the speed for this particular frequency of the wave of the nodes. We've already discussed that. We call this the phase velocity. It's the speed at which the phase moves, or that the nodes of a single wave would move along, a single wave. And we noticed by looking at this, omega over k is equal to, omega over k is 1 minus this, That's wrong. It should be... What have I got? The C upside down? Yes, the C is upside down and the N is upside down. So this should have been the other way around. Omega, wait a minute. Upside down. Omega over K is equal to C over N. The speed of sound, speed of light in the medium was this index into the speed of light in vacuum. And so, and this was for our case C over 1 minus some constant or other, which for the moment I call it A, say, over omega squared, where A was the shorthand because I'm going to have to write a lot. NQE squared over 2m epsilon naught. This phase velocity for the case of the light in glass, in X-rays in glass, for instance, was greater than the speed of light, and that was a bother because we didn't think we could send signals faster than the speed of light. So I just remind you of that. However, what we're going to discuss now is the interference of two waves in which omega and k have a definite formula relating them. You see, this formula, leaving this term out, says that k is given as a definite function of omega. To be specific, in this particular problem, the formula for k in terms of omega is k is equal to omega over c minus a over omega c, for instance. So at any rate, for each frequency, there's a definite wave number. And I want to add two such waves together. Well, I've already written down what I want to do in the first line here. But I don't make this substitution because the C isn't the same for both waves, you see. That's their different frequency. They have different phase velocities. So I must add these directly. And using the same formulas as before, I obtain the following result. It's e to the I times the difference between the two over 2 times e to the I times the sum of the two. All right, so we have a modulated wave again, a wave which travels with the mean frequency and the mean wave number, but whose strength is varying in a form which depends upon a difference frequency and a difference wave number. Now let's take the case that the modulation, the difference between the two waves is relatively small. Let's suppose that we're adding two waves whose frequencies are nearly equal, like these. Then omega 1 plus omega 2 over 2 is practically one of the omegas, and this is one of the k's. So the speed of the waves, these are, of course, the fast oscillations. The speed of the nodes is still essentially omega over k, the ratio of the t to the x in here. But look, the speed of the modulation is not the same. How much t do I need? How much do I have to change x to account for a certain amount of t? The speed that this wave goes is the ratio of this to that. The speed of the modulations, the velocity of the modulations, which is sometimes called the group velocity, is then omega 1 minus omega 2 over k1 minus k2. This depends upon the spacing, omega 1 and omega 2, and this other k1 minus k2. But if we take the case that the difference in frequency is relatively small, and the difference in wave number is then also relatively small, then this approaches in the limit the omega dk. In other words, for the slowest modulations, the slowest beats, there's a definite speed at which they travel, which is not the same as the speed of the wave. The group velocity is the derivative of omega with respect to k, and the phase velocity is omega over k. What a mysterious thing. Let's see if we can understand why. I want you to consider two waves again. I'm not going to be so successful at drawing them. Well, I'm not too bad. Out of phase and in phase here, out of phase here. Now these waves represent really the waves in space traveling along with slightly different frequencies. Now, because the velocity of the waves, the phase velocity, the velocity of the nodes of these two waves is not precisely the same, something new happens. Because it's not a case where the velocities of the nodes is independent of frequency, but depends on frequency. The phase velocity depends on the frequency. And therefore, something interesting happens. We can see as follows. Suppose we ride along with one of the waves and look at the other one. If we ride along with one of the waves and look at the other one, if they both went at exactly the same speed, then the other wave would stay right where it is relative to us. As I ride along on this crest, I ride on that crest and I see. Right opposite me, I see a crest. The two velocities are equal, the crests stay on top of each other. But it's not so that the two velocities are really equal. There's only a small difference in frequency, but there's therefore only a small difference in velocity. But because of that difference in velocity, as I ride along, the bottom wave moves slowly forward, say, or behind, say forward, relative to my wave. So as time goes on, as this picture rushes by, you must also realize that this one's rushing by a little faster. In other words, this slowly moves over to here. By the time when it gets there, the node is down here. As a matter of fact, if you think about what happens to the node, if you move this just a shade forward, you see if you move this just a shade forward, that, which way does it go? You figure it out. It either moves forward fast or backward. It's just one of those things. At any rate, you can see that the maximum moves relative to this wave as the waves go along. And therefore it is that the phase velocity is not the same as the place where the beats, the speed that the beats move. That is, the sum of these two waves has an envelope. And as the waves travel along, as these waves travel along, the envelope rides on them at a different speed. This is the speed at which signals would be transmitted. If I made any signal, that is some kind of a change in the wave that you could recognize when you listen to it, any kind of modulation of the wave, then that modulation would travel at this group velocity, provided that the modulations are relatively slow compared to the speed of the phase. When they're fast, it's much more difficult to analyze. But we take the interesting case when they're very slow, and we find a definite speed. Now I would like to show at long last that the speed of propagation of the waves in a block of waves of light, you see, in a block of or waves of X-rays in carbon or something, where this was the relation between K and omega, that the speed is not higher than the speed of light. Although the phase velocity is higher than the speed of light, an equation which is here that you can't see, that I wrote before, I will show you that the group velocity is less than the speed of light. In order to do that, I must take d omega dk. I can get that by differentiating dk d omega, if you want. It's easier. This is equal to 1 over c plus a over omega squared c, or that's 1 over the group velocity because it's the upside down of the derivative I want. The group velocity, therefore, is c divided by 1 plus a over omega squared, which is smaller than c. So this, although the phases can travel faster than the speed of light, the signals travel slower, and that was the resolution of that paradox. Of course, if we have the simple case that omega equals kc, then d omega dk is also c. So when the waves have all the phases are independent of all of have the same velocity, naturally the group has the same velocity, and that checks out. I would like now to give one more example of the phase velocity, which is extremely interesting. And that has to do with the quantum mechanics. We know that the amplitude to represent, the amplitude to find a particle at a place can, under some circumstances, vary in space and time, let's say in one dimension, in this manner, where omega is the frequency and is related to the classical idea of the energy through h omega is e. And the wave number k is related to what we would say the particle had a definite momentum p if the wave number were k. That is a perfect wave which goes on with the same amplitude everywhere. And if we square, this is the amplitude. If we take the absolute square, we get a constant, which means the probability is the same to find the particle anywhere. But suppose instead we have a situation where we know that the particle is more likely to be here than there. That we would represent by a wave which has a maximum and dies out. It isn't the same as this, which has a series of maxima, but it's possible by adding several waves together to get rid of the higher ones. So we want to represent the thing like this. And I'm going to take this distance to be fairly very long compared to the spacing of the wavelength. Now here's the situation. When they have a wave like this, it's not represented this way. but it's represented by a superposition of several waves, all at nearly the same omega and k with slight variations, beating together to make this. Now, under those circumstances, since the square of this thing represents the chance of finding a particle here, we know the particle at a given instant is most likely to be here. If now I wait a few minutes, the waves will move, and after some time, the thing will be over here. And we'd say that the particle has its chance, if it was here, if we knew it was around here originally classically, we'd expect possibly that it was over here. As a matter of fact, because we think it has a speed. After all, it's supposed to have a momentum. The whole quantum theory, then, will go into the correct classical theory of the relationship of momentum, energy, and velocity, provided it turns out that the group velocity, the velocity of the modulations, is equal to the velocity that you would obtain classically for a particle of the same momentum. It's now necessary to demonstrate that that is or is not the case. According to the classical theory, the energy is related to the velocity through an equation that goes like the mass times the speed of light squared over the square root of 1 minus the velocity squared over c. The momentum is the mass times the velocity over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. Well, that's the classical theory. And as a consequence of the classical theory, by substituting one in the other and so on, you can show that e squared minus p squared is m squared. That is the four-dimensional grand result that we've often talked about, that p mu is equal to m squared. You know? That's the relation between energy and momentum in classical theory. Now, that means, since these are going to be omegas and k's, by substitution in here, it is necessary for quantum mechanics that h omega squared over c squared minus h squared k squared is equal to m squared c squared. This, then, is the relationship between the frequency and the wave number of a wave representing a particle of mass m, a quantum mechanical amplitude wave representing a particle of mass m. From this equation, I can deduce that omega is equal to the square root c c times the square root of k squared plus m squared c squared over h squared. I just want to get everything right. But it's easy. You put this on the other side, and then multiply by c squared over h squared, and then take the square root. Now, that's the phase velocity is omega over k, which is, in fact, just to get the phase velocity, just for fun, just to see what it is omega over k. It's irrelevant, you see, because that's not what we're looking for. Omega over k is a omega is to k as e is to p, as e is to p, and if I divide e and p there, I get c squared over v. So it's got no relation to the classical velocity. In fact, it happens to be faster than the speed of light, definitely. The phase velocity, it turns out, is faster than the speed of light. But now let's look at the group velocity. The group velocity should be d omega dk, the speed that the modulations move. And I have then to differentiate a square root, which is not very hard. The derivative of this k squared is 2k, and the derivative of the square root is 1 over 2 times the square root. So I got this. That then is the formula, and I have to substitute everything back. Turns out not to be so long to substitute. The square root is, after all, omega. And therefore, if you let me, I can write this thing as c squared k over omega. Now, k over omega is p over e. So this thing is c squared p over e. But if I take p over e, in fact, if I take c squared p over e, I get the velocity of the particle a la classical mechanics. And so you see that this is the way that starting from this relationship among the waves, which is the fundamental quantum mechanical relationship, this identification into classical e and p only produces this equation. We only understand that much. But now we also understand these relationships which connect it to the velocity. Because the moment I've shown that the velocity of the group is the velocity of the particle, if the interpretation is going to make any sense. If you think it's over here, and 10 minutes later you think it's over there, as the quantum mechanics said, that's what we would say classically is the velocity of the particle. So we've shown that the velocity of the particle is c squared p over e. And if you combine this equation with this, you can unravel these two again. So we have closed the circuit on that. So that the quantum mechanics does give the classical theory of relativity, and it's all contained in the single relationship for the waves of classical mechanics, this one. Now I would like to show you another example of effect of beats, which is rather curious and a little different. I have here two pendula, which have, as you may see, a spring connecting them. Now, they are made to be very nearly the same length, and if I let go of one, it moves back and forth. And it pulls on the spring as it moves back and forth. And so all it really is a machine for generating a force which has the natural frequency of that. Therefore, as a consequence of the theory of resonance, which we studied before, when you put a force on something at just the right frequency, it will drive it. So, sure enough, this thing moving back and forth drives this. However, in this circumstance, there's a new thing that happens. Because the total energy of this system is finite, when this pours its energy into here to drive it, it finds itself losing energy until gradually, the timing is just right along with the speed, it loses all its energy and is reduced to the original condition. Then, of course, it's the red ball that has all the energy and the orange which has none. And as time goes on, you will see that it will work now in the opposite direction. Then the energy will be passed back into the orange ball, which is a very interesting, amusing phenomenon. The question I said, however, that this is related to the theory of beats. And I would like to explain how we could analyze this motion, and motion's a more complicated system, as a theory from the point of view of the theory of beats. I'll let it do one more stop before I play with it some more. Okay, now you see it went right back to where it was, and it keeps on going from here. Now you'll see the motion of any one of these two balls is an oscillation which has a size which is going up and down. And therefore, the motion of one of the balls is presumably analyzable in a new way, in that it's the sum of two numbers, two oscillations at the same time at two slightly different frequencies. Therefore, it ought to be possible to find in this system, maybe, two other motions, and to claim that the thing that you just saw was a superposition of two solutions, because this is a linear system. All the forces are proportional very closely to the displacements. I will now show you two ways that I could start it, each one of which is a perfect single frequency, absolutely periodic. You see, the one that we started with before was not. You started it this way, but it doesn't last. Pretty soon it's passing the energy to the other, and it's changing. But there are forms of starting where nothing changes. And of course, as soon as I do it, you'll understand why. If I made them go both together, since they're the same length and the spring isn't doing anything, they will swing like that for all time, assuming no friction and so on, and everything were perfect. So they go like this, and that's one frequency. And the spring is having no effect, and this frequency is the natural frequency of the two hanging from the chain. On the other hand, there's another possible motion, which has a definite frequency. And that is, if I move them oppositely, and if I could do it accurately, exactly equal distances, then again, they would be absolutely periodic, because you can kind of feel that, maybe. Because as it goes out, the spring pulls. It just adds a little force of reaction to what the gravity would do, that's all. And it just keeps the same thing oscillating at a slightly higher frequency than the other one. Why? Because the spring is pulling in addition to the gravitation, and so that it makes it like as if a little stiffer. So that the frequency of this is just a shade higher than the other. So this system has two ways that it can oscillate. It can either oscillate in a way in which they are symbolized by both going this way and oscillating all the time at one frequency, or it could be that they were going in opposite directions and at a different frequency, slightly higher. Now, the actual motion of the thing, because the system is linear, can be represented as a superposition of the two. And the subject of this lecture is the effects of adding two motions at slightly different frequency, or at different frequency. And so we think, what would happen if we add these two solutions, for example? If at t equals 0, one motion is this way and the other this way, the sum of the two means that this ball, having been impressed by the first motion up and by the second motion down, is at 0, while this ball, having been in both motions plus, is 2 units up. So it started that way, and that's the way I started it. Now, so I really have both motions at the same time in equal amounts, or in equal amplitudes. As time goes on, however, the phase, this oscillates and this oscillates, but the phase of this relative, this is slowly shifting. But that means then that after a long time, when the time is enough that this could have gone 900 and a half oscillations, while this only went 900, this thing will be out of phase of what it was before. That is, this motion, this arrow would be trying to go down and that up, and we would find that these two had been beating against each other and that this has fallen to zero. In the meantime, of course, these two had been beating, but they started at zero and now they're full strength ahead. So you could also analyze the same motion either by the idea that there's a resonance and that one passes energy to the other because it's in resonance and it pales all the energy over, or else, in another way, by the superposition of two motions at two different frequencies. I think I'll leave for the next time the writing down the equations for this. And then, instead of that, I will say a little bit more about the wave equation. This, I only say, to give you some view of the future. Not that you will understand everything exactly, but just to see what it's going to look like. First of all, the wave equation for sound in one dimension was the second derivative of chi with respect to x equals 1 over c squared, where c is the speed of whatever the wave is. In the case of sound, it's the sound speed. In the case of light, it's the speed of c. So in case. Now, and it showed that the displacements would propagate themselves along at a certain speed. But the pressure also propagates along at a certain speed, and the density also propagates along at a certain speed. So we should expect that the pressure would satisfy the same equation, incidentally. And I'll leave it to you to prove that it does. Hint. Rho E is equal to the rate of change of chi with respect to x, I believe, within a sign. Therefore, if you'll differentiate this expression with respect to x, you'll immediately discover that d chi dx satisfies the same equation. That is to say, rho E satisfies the same equation. But PE is proportional to rho E, and therefore PE does too. So the pressure, the displacements, everything. Oh, that's a terrible mistake. The pressure, the displacements, and everything satisfy the same wave equation. That's one interesting point. So usually you see the sound equation in terms of pressure instead of in terms of displacement, because the pressure has no direction, and the displacement has a direction, and it's easier to analyze the pressure. The next matter I would like to mention is this. We know that the sound wave solution in one dimension is this. But we also know that in three dimensions, a wave would be represented by e to the minus I kxx minus kyy minus kzz. Oh, I forgot. An omega is equal to kc sub s. And in this case, omega square will be k square c sub s square, which is, of course, k sub x square plus k sub y square plus k sub z square times c sub s square. Now, what I want to guess at is what the correct wave equation is in three dimensions. Naturally, for the case of sound, that can be deduced by doing the dynamic argument that I made in one dimension in three dimensions. But I'm not going to do that. Instead, I just write down what comes out. And here's what comes out. The second derivative of p, or anything, with respect to x, plus the second derivative of p with respect to y, plus the second derivative of p with respect to z, is equal to 1 over c squared times the second derivative of p with respect to t. That this is true can be obtained by combining these two results, because every time I differentiate with respect to x, I multiply by kx. If I differentiate twice, it's equivalent to multiplying by kx squared. If I differentiate with respect to y, so that this term would become minus kx squared times pe for that wave. This term becomes minus ky squared pe. This term becomes minus kz squared pe. If you don't understand what I'm doing and you don't believe it, please substitute this expression into this wave equation, and this will come out. Is equal to minus 1 over cs squared times omega squared p. At least this term we've done before. And then if I take away the p's and change the sign, you see that this relationship is the one that I want. Working backwards then, I can't resist writing down the grand equation which corresponds to this. In the case of light, there's no term here. In the case of sound, it's the same. K squared is omega squared over C squared. But for quantum mechanical waves, the relationship is that omega squared over C squared, this is now the speed of light, over K squared is equal to M squared C squared over H squared. And what then is going to be, where K is a three-dimensional vector and this is the wave? What then is the equation which will produce this? If phi represents the amplitude for finding a particle at position x, y, z at the time t, then the great equation of quantum mechanics for free particles is this one. First of all, the relativity character of it is suggestive, let's say. We didn't prove anything, but here's x, y, z, and t in a nice combination like relativity usually does. Second, it's a wave equation, which if you tried a plane wave, would produce as a consequence that omega squared over c at k squared, I'm sorry, there's a sign wrong. No, right, that minus k squared plus omega squared over c squared is m squared c squared over h squared, which is the right relationship for quantum mechanics. But it contains still another great thing that the wave equation contains that the solution doesn't. The remark that any superposition of waves is also a solution. You see, so this contains all of the quantum mechanics and the relativity that we have been discussing so far, as long as it deals at least with a single particle in empty space with no external potentials or forces on it. Thank you.
Hi. I was wondering if I could ask you a question completely off the subject.
Yes.
How would one go about detecting whether a wave is circularly polarized as opposed to elliptical?
All right. Supposing it's light?
Light or microwave?
Well, first let's take light. First, you have to have some kind of a thing that's sensitive to polarization in some way or another. For instance, the Polaroid. Now, if your only question is whether it's elliptical or circular, that's easy. If those are the only alternatives, because then the experiment has less to check on. If it's circular and you put the Polaroid this way, this way, this way, this way, this way, this way, the intensity is always the same. If it's elliptical, it'll be weak when you've got the Polaroid this way and stronger when you've got the Polaroid that way. So that's one way that you can distinguish elliptical from circular. The reason I say that isn't everything is because you unpolarize light. Would also look like circular, the same intensity in all directions.
Well, we have to play a Polaroid first.
You're not a Polaroid, a quarter wave plate.
No, first a Polaroid to get it linearly polarized, and then into a quarter wave or something else.
Well, that's to make the circular poles. Yeah, but if you want, you ask the opposite. Suppose you had the wave and you wanted to find out which it was. Isn't that what you asked?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm making a, let's call it a quarter wave plate, a type of phase plate.
Right.
I'm making the phase plate, and I want to know how thick do I have to make it.
Yes.
Make it circularly polarized.
Yes.
So first I'm going to get a linearly polarized beam.
Right, right.
Pass it into the phase plate.
Right, right.
And I want to have some way of checking the outcoming beam.
Right. Well, the easiest, if you got it as simple as that, and you know, and you have it linearly polarized, just put it through another Polaroid and turn it. If it's all equal intensity, it'll be all right. There are more sensitive tests. The other sensitive test would be, of course, you don't know how thick the quarter wave plate ought to be. But if you had another quarter wave plate, or you double the thickness, you should get back to zero when you had cross polaroids. That's much more sensitive. So you could first get the halfway plate and then cut it in half or something. There are a lot of ways, depending on how accurate you want it, but the easiest way would be this. Yes?
CAM magazines, I think that we talked about single sideband.
That's what I was talking about. Well, they just cut out the bottom sideband by filters so that the stuff which is transmitted is the carrier on the upper sideband.
Yeah, and that has one advantage over two sidebands.
Well, that there's less room, that's all. That's it. That's the whole reason, that you can put more stations in there without interfering with each other. That's the whole idea. That's all there is to it. That's all they mean. They're more efficient in the sense they use a narrower, channel. Suppose that you were allowed by the FCC only so and so much width of channel.
Yeah.
Now, if you decide with that given width of channel, and that's all you've got, that you're going to send things, if you'd send the carrier in the middle and the sidebands on the side, you could only send up to a certain frequency, half the width of the channel. But if you make one sideband only transmitter, then you can transmit frequencies that are higher, namely up to the whole width of the band, which is much more effective. And more, you can send better resolution, higher. It depends how much room you have. I mean, if you only want to send 10 kilocycles and you got that much room, it doesn't make any difference. But if you're squeezing to get as much higher frequency out as you can, and they only give you that much room, then you can put it in this way. In fact, it is squeezed because there's a lot of trouble with the television because they need such a wide band. That's why they have to be at such high frequency, because if they were lower, they'd use up the whole band. I mean, you'd say one guy would go from 0 to 6, another guy from 0 to 6 to 12 megacycles, and that would be the end of it. And nobody could transmit anything from 0 to 12 megacycles because of the interference from the television transmitter. But they don't. They start at 54. And you want them as narrow as possible, so the half sideband scheme is a clever invention for getting half as much. It's more efficient in that sense. They use the bands more efficiently. They get more information across in the band. Yeah.
Is this supposed to be H-bar, or is there some difference?
Of course. No, that was H-bar. No, I'm sorry. If you want. There shouldn't have been here, or there should have been, one or the other.
Okay.
If M is the rest... If M is the rest mass, then that's it. But I usually used, I think, when I talked about the theory, I didn't use 2 M's. I think I kept using an M. I forget what I did when I was teaching before. It's the same M. It's the rest mass. This M is the rest mass.
And I'm not sure whether our TA introduced the naught or not.
I see. I don't know. I tried to do it without it because we get, in more advanced work, we never talk anything anymore about the mass of the thing in motion. You talk about the energy just as easily because they're related by C squared. So to avoid saying it, you don't have to.
You can use the momentum.
Well, we use momentum and energy and this and that. When mass, if you kept putting noughts on it, you'd have too many subscripts when you get... I mean, like in the fundamental equations, there'd always be extra subscripts. By the time you get over there, you're never going to look at the mass again, if you know what I mean. You can look at the energy of it, you can look at the momentum of it, and so on, but you're not going to look at the mass of it in the usual sense of the moving mass. So you want to get, sooner or later, you want to get rid of the zeros. So I tried to get rid of them at the beginning. Okay? Yeah.
I have a question about something on here. I was reading this over last night.
Right.
And you speak about the probability here of finding two molecules of a distance r,
yes,
e to the minus potential energy,
right,
kt. And now, well, the probability would exceed 1 then when the potential energy goes negative. Wouldn't
relatively, it? Answer, this is not normalized, right. The relative chance to find it here and here is proportional to this.
Oh.
I said that I say the probability is?
The answer is?
How do they arrange themselves on the answer? Well, this doesn't really say anything. The answer is, on the average, the number per unit volume is proportional to this. There's always a constant of proportionality. You see, the relative chance to be, for instance, here per unit volume and here per unit volume is the ratio of these two exponentials. In other words, it's equal to the energy e to the minus the potential energy difference over kt.
Yeah. Okay,
right.
I see that.
Well, I should have made that more clear. Yes, that's
another
right.
Thing.
Here it did say it right, see?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to follow this particular step up on... The Schrodinger equation. And
it's not the Schrodinger equation, but
isn't that up there?
No, because there's no potentials on it. It's a free particle, no forces, no electric potentials, no disturbance.
Uh-huh.
Free particle.
That's the free particle.
Yeah, that's the one you use for figuring out how it goes between slits and stuff when it's not being interacted on by anything.
Is there any place I can follow this up? Any text? Any particular text?
Well, they're all over the place, and I don't know exactly where to suggest.
No particular references.
No, they're all over, almost all the quantum mechanics books. As soon as they start to talk about the relativity, you'll probably have this equation sooner or later.
Yeah, but they must get pretty complicated pretty soon.
I know. I know. Well, this is already beyond the stuff we have ordinarily, and I just wanted to show what the future would look like. Let me just think about a reference for him a minute. See, the trouble is that if anybody who goes any further than this is going to get himself complicated. And so you can't have a reference that's simple and which tells about this, because they go for the next step after this is already something complicated.
Well, if I can avoid something like, you know, calculus of variations or something.
Yeah, well, I don't really know which quantum mechanics books would have it. I'm sorry, I can't tell you. Excuse me.
The velocity in sending information is less than wave velocity.
No, it's less than the speed of light. No, it isn't true. V group is not always less than V phase. For sound, they're equal. Because for sound, omega equal KCS, so that the derivative is equal to the, so the phase velocity and the group velocity are equal. Not exactly. There's a little bit of dispersion of sound, but light has got much more dispersion. It's very, very little, you know, the sound. The sound dispersion is very, very to the size between you. Well, in the gas, it isn't so much dispersion as a terrible absorption. I mean, it's a mixture, of course. You can't have one without the other.
There is another nice example of dispersion, which is a little bit harder.
Water waves.
Quantitatively, as I say, for them to analyze quantitatively, but it shows up nicely in the propagation properties of the wave, and that is just the transverse waves on a wire.
Yes, that's the same equation. Is it?
Yeah,
I had another one to explain, which is water waves, but I didn't have the time. But I didn't answer your question yet.
What is it? Well, the point is, because if this term is in the wire,
it goes further than the wave wants.
And if you just listen to the information, touch the wire and
no, the information goes at the group velocity. The speed at which the nodes move is called the phase velocity, and no signals go at that velocity. Now, in the two examples which I showed you, in both examples, the phase velocity was faster than the group velocity. But it isn't always true. There are other examples in which the group velocity is faster than the phase velocity. No, that you don't get you anywhere. When you cuddle a wave on and off sharply, you can get the same effect. You see, if I make two waves interfere, then I get this kind of an envelope, all right? Now, if I take another one of the same kind but with a slightly different carrier, I can make this part of the wave opposite that, so I can build this way, and so on. And it turns out that even this, what you call turning a wave on sharp, can be represented as a superposition of the wave that you turned on, plus slightly sidebands, only they spread all over the place. Like a square wave, yeah, which has sidebands and so on. And it's spread all over the place. And the exact behavior of this is very complicated. There's not one single velocity. You see, the moment that I have too wide a range here, away from the central frequency, then this is not exactly equal to the derivative. So in a certain sense, each part of the group is going at a different velocity. And that means the shape of the pulse changes. So there's no single velocity anymore in this case. So if you had a sudden turning on, what happens is that you get a thing like that after a while, and all kinds of irregular whatnots in front and so on. So you have to tell me what part you want the velocity of. And so that's why it's a little complicated to talk about the speed of a sharp pulse. The speed of a sharp pulse is something completely different. It really is the limiting value of the group velocity, of the phase velocity at very high frequencies, if there is one. That's what it is, because it's the highest frequency that determines the sharpest corner is the speed No, that isn't true, because there may be lower frequencies which go faster than the highest one. Now, there's no general rule to tell you how fast the first piece of a signal will arrive.
Except for optical phenomena.
Then it's the velocity of light. But in water waves, for example, if you'd made a bump in water and let go and ask how long it takes to get to the shore, it's very complicated. So I can't answer. There's no general rule that says that the group velocity is less than the phase velocity or more than or equal to the speed at which a sharp pulse would go, because that isn't a definite speed. The front shifts around and so on. But slowly modulated signals, they have the group.
Okay, well, except when you define the opposite direction.
Yeah? One could be the minus.
You usually define the velocity of a pulse as later on it is rounded off in some way, and then you sort of take the mean.
Yeah, that's all right, but if you do it that way, of course, then the moment it gets rounded off, you've got a relatively small range, and then it has a downward direction. I couldn't help show them that.
That's good. That was good.
Exhibit a jewel.
No, don't do that. It's scary.
You might think that'd be your name.
What is it?
I don't know.
What?
I couldn't remember. I couldn't find the name for that equation.